اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The United States has been accused of a huge covert pro-Western digital campaign targeting Middle East or West Asia. It was reported that dozens of social media accounts, which have been closed, as it's been reported at this point, operated for years in an attempt to influence people in the Middle East or West Asia and Asia. A new study believes the U.S. is behind it. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will ask why the U.S. deemed it so important to alter or to influence the opinions and thoughts of people in this region in particular, and what was their goal behind this. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, joins us. And also editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, who joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me ask you a simple question here from you, Arya Barzari. When you come to understanding what this title means of what the U.S. has been accused, can you break it down for us? Because maybe it could be a bit confusing to some. The accusation, a huge covert pro-Western digital campaign targeting Middle East and in part Asia, which includes Russia and China.
Sure. Actually, it's nothing new when you look at it from a historical perspective. I mean, the U.S. has been always involved in covert plans and missions, either by, coups against various countries, committing coups, inciting coups, or via media, such as the Radio Free Europe during the Cold War, or even after that. What is new in this instance is the use or the abuse of social media. And what is even more interesting is that giant social media companies such as Twitter and Facebook decided to speak up and speak against the U.S. and UK government and played the role of whistleblowers. While for years we used to hear scandals that were Twitter and Facebook managers were involved in it, such as Cambridge Analytica and also various scandalous programs that were accusing Twitter and Facebook companies of trying to manipulate information.
So what do you think they decided to speak up now? I mean, this thing was in operation for 5 years. And I can almost bet that it's still going on in one form or another, and even prior to 2012, because it cites the time period of 2012 to 5 years from that point on. So why speak now? Why would they target the U.S. in a sense now?
Well, at this point, we cannot say for sure. We can only speculate that they had enough of the government suppression, and they decided to fight back a little bit. And also, they were hugely harmed by the leaks and reports about how they abused people's trust on them, and how they used the information that was supposed to be private and sold it to third parties. So I think they are trying to buy some legitimacy for themselves and try to recover some of the damage that was done previously to them, and show to the outside world, show to the users that we are not that corrupt, and we are reliable and trustworthy social media companies, and we are independent, so to speak, from governments of U.S., and UK. But this is only, I think, I suppose, is the tip of iceberg that these two companies decided to reveal. And sure, the rest of it will stay hidden for years.
Well, I mean, Kevin Barrett, when you take a look at what was done, which I'd like for you to really expand on it for us, from what we understand, there were memes, petitions, fake news, AI-altered profile photos, propaganda, hashtags, and all sorts of things that had to be superficially made up, and that's what the U.S. has been accused of. Tell us the expanding role that the U.S. has been accused of in this particular instance, which focused on influencing people in the Middle East or West Asia, and not to mention Russia and China also.
Well, yeah, the U.S. has worked through these social media companies and through the internet, which was created in the U.S. by DARPA. Let's remember that DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, actually came up with the internet, and it was originally designed as a way to avoid any kind of blockage or breakdown in the event of nuclear war. So it was a command and control and communication system, 3 C's, that was meant to survive nuclear war and be used by the American military intelligence community. That's what the internet originally was. And so they founded it, they got the infrastructure and built the infrastructure to their advantage, and they've been in control of it disproportionately, at least ever since. Now, it's a little bit like the MKUltra program and LSD. And you may recall that the CIA developed LSD, and along with a long list of other drugs that it was using to try to brainwash people. And then the hippies got hold of it, and pretty soon they were sort of deprogramming people from the CIA mentality. So here, the internet, of course, has become a tool that anybody can use to a certain extent, but the people who built that infrastructure are still in a position to use it more powerfully than others. And so I guess these revelations, which I haven't really had a chance to investigate carefully, would indicate that what's come out is stuff that we kind of already very much suspected, which is that the social media companies are very much part of the U.S. military intelligence community. Google is widely known to be essentially a branch of the CIA. Google Alphabet has been involved in some of the ugliest CIA criminal black ops, including biological weapons in Tbilisi, Georgia, smuggling the chemical weapons into Syria for use in false flags blamed falsely on Bashar al-Assad, and all sorts of things. So Google is the CIA. Facebook is the CIA plus Israel. Mark Zuckerberg is a Zionist who consults with Bibi Netanyahu. And so what these people do is that they use these outfits, the social media, to spin reality in the direction that their leadership wants them to. And sure, they've been doing this to the entire planet. They're doing it to the West, and they're doing it to the Middle East and the Islamic world.
Well, they have done it to West Asia, or Middle East, as it's called, to the extent where 40% of their focus was the area of the Middle East or West Asia, and in particular, Iran was their focus. So, Mr. Mohammadi, why do you think the U.S. has such a keen interest in trying to influence and shape thoughts and stances towards Iran through social media? Why this intensity behind that?
Well, it's not a secret that the U.S. Governments, since at least Ronald Reagan, were trying to topple the Iranian system, the Iranian, and also they were working against the Iranian revolution. So what they are doing is exactly trying to brainwash people, which they are not and will not be successful in that. But they might be successful in creating small echo chambers where people who are pro-West and anti-government in Iran or China or Russia might become under the illusion that the majority of people think like them. And the social media is very capable of doing that. And it is addictive. You know, when thousands of fake accounts like your tweet or your Instagram post and give you this wrong impression that, you know, being against, working against your country is a good thing and it's a noble thing according to the Western standards, then you, people, which are very small percentage of the population, might be brainwashed into doing more vulgar things. And they are, I think that they are banking on that. They are, I'm sure, more wise than, you know, to think that they are capable of toppling the government or the system in Iran, Russia or China by thousands or even millions of fake accounts. The time that such techniques could work, for example, during the Arab uprising is long past, and people in Middle East, China and Russia are wiser than that, and they don't get you know fooled twice by the same tricksters.
Okay, we're going to get to some of the things that are fake and not when it comes to Iran, and Kevin Barrett, when it comes to Russia, it actually was cited as being one of the most active campaigns in which the Russian-speaking internet users in Central Asia were targeted, and they focused on criticizing Russia over the civilian deaths, according to the way they saw it, and other atrocities when it came to the Ukraine conflict. Isn't that a way for the U.S. and these fake accounts and what have you wanting to convince people who may doubt what is going on in the Ukraine conflict to accuse Russia rather than, in a sense, then overshadowing what Ukraine is actually doing, because Ukraine also is responsible for some of the deaths, and in the bigger picture, to convince that target that this military operation that Russia is conducting is not a good thing.
The Western mind control machine has actually done pretty well in this war on Russia through Ukraine, which is what it is. This is a Western war of aggression on Russia. But the global consciousness of that is pretty mixed because the Western oligarchs own a disproportionate share of the global media. So they are using all sorts of means, including the creation and maintenance of huge numbers of fake social media accounts, spam bots, and so on, to try to make people think that essentially the whole world sides with them against Russia, which of course isn't true. The world largely has sided with Russia. The vast majority of the world has refused to go along with the sanctions. And this propaganda blaming Russia for atrocities in Ukraine is actually quite shameful, because the way the U.S. has fought its wars has been to make no effort whatsoever to spare civilian populations, but on the contrary, to deliberately target civilian populations. When the U.S. went into the former Yugoslavia, and then when it went into Iraq, and of course its actions elsewhere in Afghanistan and so on, always involve attacking civilian infrastructure, making life miserable for civilians. They killed perhaps 500,000 plus Iraqi children, as Madeleine Albright admitted, during the 1990s due to the destruction of Iraqi infrastructure, leading the children to be drinking polluted water and so on. So the Americans deliberately
Let me ask you this, Kevin Barrett. Since you're mentioning Iraq, isn't that one of the things that the U.S. has realized its mistake in a sense? And that is why West Asia or the Middle East is focused, because many here in this region doubt very highly the intentions that the U.S. has overall when it comes to the way that it exercises its foreign policy, given the fact that they have firsthand accounts of what happened in Iraq.
Well, yeah, the U.S. is behind the eight ball in propagandizing West Asia. And so it is, of course, trying to claim that Russia is committing all these terrible human rights violations in Ukraine, when the reality of the situation is that if Russia had chosen to wage its war on Ukraine the way the U.S. waged its war on Iraq, you would have huge numbers of Ukrainian casualties. They would have leveled much of Kiev, which Russia could do any moment that it wants. But Russia is taking this very slow, methodical approach, minimizing its own casualties and minimizing Ukrainian civilian casualties. And in the areas they're fighting, most of the people identify as Russian and speak Russian and are on the side of the Russians. So it's obvious why they're doing that. But that's the truth. And unfortunately, the media, and including social media, as we're seeing, is dominated by these Anglo-Zionist oligarchs who basically lie about everything. You know, Putin may not always tell the truth, but he usually does. Sure. And when he said that the West is the empire of lies, that was the truth.
Well, I was going to ask you now, Mr. Mohammadi, as I alluded to before, some of the fake news that has been propagated by the U.S. as a whole, and of course through probably some of these accounts that for the period of 5 years targeted Iran. And I'd like to ask you about those and see what you think, such as the lie that the U.S. has spread about Iran being a leading state sponsor of terrorism. We could counter that in a sense, and I'd like to get your reaction of how the truth on that is that the war on terror was conducted against groups like Al-Qaeda, Daesh, or Al-Shabaab, none of which are backed by Iran. So that's one of the falsities that the U.S. has premised when it comes to spreading the lie of the Iran being a leading state sponsor of terrorism. Do you agree with that? And what other instances of fake news on Iran do you think is being spread online, even to this day perhaps, by the U.S. through online fake accounts?
I totally agree with you. And to add to that, if you look at the region, Iran was the only country for years to support Syria against terrorist groups such as ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra. And even in Iraq, Iran was there to defend Erbil even before the Kurdish region's usual allies in the West. So of course it is a propaganda, and of course Iran is a victim of terrorism. The latest one was the coward act by the U.S. of assassinating General Mortier Qasem Soleimani. So if we look at the record of the countries and not at the propaganda, it is clear which state is committing terror and which state is fighting terror. We were fighting ISIS in Iraq, in Syria, and we were fighting terrorism inside our country for years as well, and still are fighting terrorism. But propaganda machine is getting more and more sophisticated, especially with the advent of social media. And if we use the term coined by French philosopher Baudrillard, the hyper-real or hyper-reality that is created inside this virtual medias and virtual space, sometimes it doesn't refer to the outside reality at all, and it does not need to. So those signifiers don't refer to a signified in the real world. Uh-huh. They are signifiers that refer to the other signifiers, to use the philosophical terms. So it's all in their minds and in the minds of people who are manipulated by these manipulating machines, which are social media, and they have very, very sophisticated algorithms that follow your likes and dislikes and the patterns of your behavior, I mean people's behavior, in order to brainwash them. How much they are successful in that, it needs to be analyzed.
Well, this particular study actually said that some of these, overall, Kevin Barrett, they were not that successful. Actually, they were not able to sway the audience to the intended goals that they had. So why do you think that is? Because that, in a sense, and my question to you is, doesn't that show that the audience out there, the viewers out there, are much smarter now, more informed, especially when it comes to the propaganda leveled against countries like Iran, perhaps, and even Russia and China?
I think that's true. Yes, I think that it's, especially the West Asia region has traditionally been a very difficult audience for Western propaganda. There's this term, the Arab street, that, of course, has been used by the Zionist oligarchs that own Western media and the people in the government who are really annoyed that ordinary people in the Arab world and the rest of West Asia don't seem to go along with the Western narrative on all sorts of things.
Okay.
And it drives them crazy. And sure. I guess that's continuing now as the social media manipulation is probably cultural factors. It's probably harder for them to figure out what motivates an individual in West Asia than it is for them to figure out what motivates an individual in, say, the United States. They probably just don't have enough sort of psyops expertise.
Well, thank you for that. I'm sorry to jump in. We're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, and editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett. Thank you both for your input. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yikava Tapoy and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, calling for good and forbidding evil in the family's environment. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of calling for good and forbidding evil in the environment of the family, in the Islamic lifestyle. Obviously, when we talk about the calling for good and forbidding evil, we must know that where can we apply all these things and where we can perform this action. And it starts from the family. Why? Because the family is the smallest social gathering that we have, which starts from the husband and wife, which starts from the parents and the children. And this small gathering, which is a social gathering, we need to start from there and performing this command, which has been made by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that we must call people towards the good and forbid evil. Therefore, when we talk about the family environment, it is necessary that first of all we make our family members aware of what is good and what is bad, so that when we want our family to reach to perfection, we want to get the perfection, and through this material life, we want to reach to the spiritual levels of the perfection, it is necessary that those who are close to us, those who are living next to us, those who we socialize, we live with them 24 hours, who are next to us, we make this environment peaceful. We make this environment Islamic. We must have an Islamic lifestyle in our home, in our house. And it can be started when we start making aware our family members, when we perform the call for good and forbidding evil in our family. And therefore, we can have this peaceful life if we are performing in our family environment. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of calling for good and forbidding evil in the family environment. We said that it is necessary that a person starts with his family. He starts with his house. He makes his house a spiritual place where he can get to perfection. But on the other hand, when we talk about calling for good, the first step is to make people aware, to make our family members aware of what are the goods and what are evil. But on the other hand, we cannot say our family members every time to perform good. Why? Because unless we have not seen a munkar or evil from them, we cannot stop them. Yes, we make aware them, we give the awareness, we make them to have the knowledge of what is good and what is bad. But on the other hand, then a person in my family has not committed any kind of evil, or if he has not left any kind of goodness, I cannot give him a caution, or I cannot tell him how to perform it. So basically, if the family members when we talk about the Amar bil Maruf and Nahi anil Munkar, it means that to do not just say people not to do this, not to do this. This does not mean that you're performing the Nahi anil Munkar. It means that when a person performs anything which is evil, you must stop them. You must tell them that this is an evil. And you give them some initial knowledge about all those things so that they can prevent themselves from performing such things. Therefore, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran that, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا قُوا أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَهْلِيكُمْ نَارًا. Those who believed, save yourself and your family members from the hellfire. وَقُودُهَا النَّاسُ وَالْحِجَارَةُ. And you must save them. Why? Because the hellfire is the mankind and the stones. Therefore, we must have an environment in our family which takes us towards the perfection, where we are not performing evil and we are performing the goodness, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On the 44th anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri stressed that the kidnapping of the prominent Shiite cleric was a crime that is a sovereign Lebanese case.
The failure of the current Libyan authorities to cooperate with the Lebanese authorities is considered to be collusion. The Arab League must press the authorities to cooperate.
Commenting on the issue of the demarcation of the country's southern maritime border with the Israeli occupying regime, the House Speaker accused the U.S. envoy of buying time.
We will not concede our rights, nor will we concede our sovereignty, and we will defend our land, sea, and resources with all our might. The ball now is in the court of the U.S. The U.S. envoy Hochstein said that he will be absent for 2 weeks, but 1 month has passed, and we have not received an answer.
People from all over the country came to the southern town of Tyre to commemorate the man who was seen as a hope for the oppressed and a reason to stop internal strife.
I don't have much to say except that I'm touched by all this love for Imam Sadr. May God uncover his fate.
Imam Sadr resembles the light, the beam of light, that at a certain time, in the midst of darkness, came to Lebanon and led Lebanon and the Lebanese to a new life, life of accepting the other, of cherishing the other, life of victory.
You see, you can have tears when you see all these people are coming, just because that person is a very exceptional. He came as a blessing from the sky, I would consider, in the middle amongst of all when Lebanon was suffering and still suffering.
The only verified fact concerning Imam Sadr's case was that he arrived in the Libyan capital of Tripoli at the end of August 1978 with two companions, Sheikh Mohammed Yaqub and journalist Abbas Badreddin. Back then, the regime of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi had claimed that the three men boarded a flight to Italy on August 31st. But al-Sadr and his companions were never seen again.
Many had hoped that the fall of former dictator Muammar Gaddafi would reveal the secrets about the disappearance of Sayyid Musa Sadr. But those secrets were buried with the Libyan dictator, which led to a dead-end investigation. Maryam Saleh from Tyre, South Lebanon.
The Iranian Foreign Minister's short notice visit to Russia carries major messages, as it comes at a time when Tehran is carefully examining the recent U.S. draft response to the 2015 deal, which holds Russia as one of its signatories. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was warmly greeted in Moscow on Wednesday by his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The Russian Foreign Minister once again reaffirmed his country's support for a fair deal or no deal.
The Russian Federation shares the same stances as Iran towards the 2015 deal. We believe that the U.S.'s illegal sanctions against Iran must be removed to save the deal.
Meanwhile, Tehran and Washington are currently exchanging comments on the European Union's new draft proposal for the revival of what is known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran has repeatedly said it wants a sustainable accord, which includes guarantees that would make the deal immune to any possible withdrawal by the U.S. administration.
My colleagues are thoroughly reviewing the American text. We seek stronger and more reliable guarantees from the U.S. to prevent any future withdrawal from the deal by the U.S. government.
The 2015 deal was cast into limbo in 2018 when Washington unilaterally walked out of the accord and reinstated sanctions on Tehran. Iran, in return, scaled back some of its commitments to the pact, saying it will return to its obligations only after the U.S. removes all anti-Iran sanctions. The Vienna talks over the revival of the accord have faced a hiatus over the past 5 months. The discussions are now set to resume after Iran approves and accepts the U.S. draft response.
The Iranian foreign minister's visit to Moscow is of great significance, since Russia is a key player in the 2015 deal and shares Iran's stance in the accord. Now, while the United States' response to the EU draft proposal is still under examination in Tehran, here, Sergei Lavrov says Russia will accept nothing less than Tehran's full rights under the agreement. Yusuf Jalali, Moscow.
On the 30th of August last year, the last of the U.S. troops hastily left Kabul International Airport, marking the end of a two-decade occupation of Afghanistan. On its anniversary, the people of Afghanistan are celebrating this occasion. They say being independent and free from any occupation is a great blessing for the nation.
This is a victorious day for Afghans. 1 year ago, the U.S. occupying forces were forced to leave Afghanistan. Of course, they were defeated against the will of our people. We are proud that another invasion failed in our country.
Most Afghan people believe the U.S. invasion brought them nothing but more conflict, poverty, destruction, and suffering. They say today it is Afghans who are in charge of their own country and that they should work to build their homeland.
In the past 20 years, we didn't witness anything except bombardments, destruction, and civilian casualties. People across the country were busy burying their loved ones every day.
We have gathered here to mark Afghanistan's independence from the U.S. occupation. Last year, on this day, the U.S. withdrew from our country. We are happy that the U.S. is no more present here. But unfortunately, our country is reeling from economic problems. I hope the new rules of Afghanistan provide job opportunities and protect the rights of all Afghans.
Participants also called on the U.S. to learn from its past mistakes and stop the ongoing ill policies towards Afghanistan and its people. 1 year on, Afghans are celebrating the U.S. withdrawal from their country. People here say they are happy that the U.S. invasion was ended because they were exhausted by Americans' gross violations. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
England's healthcare service workers receiving national praise for staying in the job through the grueling days of the pandemic to save lives. An increasing number of them, doctors, nurses, and midwives, have either quit the service or are actively considering to do so.
Profits have risen by 35% in the UK since the pandemic. More money to the rich, but not to those that are sick or for people that care for them.
The most recent culprit, poor pay. Rejecting a 4% pay increase in the face of soaring inflation, they're set to vote for industrial action.
Even with all those budgeting, we are still struggling. And so what would help in the NHS really was to increase our salary like everybody else is getting bonuses. We are not. Why? Why is this? And if you're not going to increase our salary, at least do something about transportation or even the parking. We can't be paying for things like this. It's ridiculous.
There are other reasons, too, for the exodus. A recent survey by union-led With NHS Staff campaign found stress, burnout, a feeling of abandonment after the pandemic. Some are having to use food banks or sleep inside hospitals. And it doesn't stop there.
There were other abuses of staff which made themselves clear, which also manifested. And actually, a large part of the nursing workforce who want to learn also cite discrimination. And there's a large amount of bullying, harassment, intimidation, discrimination that goes hand in hand with not every environment within the NHS, but within certain environments.
More people leaving the NHS means more work to be done by those who stay while they wait for the tens of thousands of vacancies across the country to be filled. A negative spiral hard to overcome in addition to the cost of living crisis. And then there's the years of underfunding and a wholesale drive to privatization, regardless of which party is in power.
The plan to privatize the NHS is not piecemeal. It's wholesale. I'm afraid Labour and Tory are like this. There isn't a fundamental difference in their attitude. We're already facing a winter bed crisis now. It's August, okay? And it's only going to get worse through the winter. So there is an under-provision in order to force people who can't get adequate care from the NHS into the private sector.
Created after World War II by a Labour government, the NHS is a publicly funded healthcare system, free at the point of need. Decades later, though, it's facing acute staff shortages, underfunding, and rapid privatization, which means that the crown jewel of Britain's public healthcare provision may soon be no more. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Pakistan is racing against time to prevent further loss of life and accelerate aid deliveries to those affected by relentless monsoon rains and devastating flooding, which have led to a staggering number of casualties and caused billions of dollars in damage. Fears of flooding around the riverbanks prompted thousands from north to south to flee their homes, with some living on highways with their livestock miles away from their flooded villages and towns. Many still are not ready to leave their houses underwater.
Our houses have been washed away with floods. With everything we had, we have nothing to lose now. We are living in miserable conditions and waiting for help from the government.
Millions of Pakistanis affected by the worst flooding in a decade are in desperate need of aid. Thousands are living in temporary shelters, as the authorities say they have been overwhelmed by the scale of the disaster.
We evacuated people from low-lying areas. Almost around 50,000 people were evacuated within a span of 10 hours. The relief side is ongoing. The district administration is providing meals, medicines, lodging, and all other facilities.
Press TV's crew visited a flood-hit region on the bank of River Kabul in Nowshera district of one of the worst-hit provinces of Pakistan, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Powerful flash floods caused the Kabul River to swell, sweeping away bridges overnight, cutting off the local population from road access. However, rescue workers say that they have managed to save the lives of thousands of residents thanks to early evacuations.
We remain successful in preventing life losses as our rescue teams make it possible to evacuate people before the flood water hits the nearby population on the bank of River Kabul. Now we are trying to deliver food via boats to the people who are still stranded in flood water.
Relief camps have been established by the Pakistani government in various parts of the country for flood victims. However, many remote regions are still waiting for rescue teams.
The remains of the flood show the intensity of the disaster that broke the record of past 30 years. An estimate suggests that over 33 million people are affected by the tragedy. The future of those who are displaced are in limbo, as nobody knows how and where they will rebuild their lives. Nasir Kazmi, Nowshera district of northwestern Pakistan.
Afghan women have been struggling for their rights under the Taliban rule. Recently, they have launched this cultural spot under the name of Women's Library. There are more than 2,000 books in this library. Women and girls can borrow books or enjoy reading them here. Meanwhile, the founders of the library say this place offers plenty more than just books.
Our aim for setting up this library is to provide teenage girls with a place to study, communicate, and receive an education. Our second goal is to provide a cultural spot for those women who have lost their jobs and have nothing to do. You know that today many Afghan women are literate and don't accept forced isolation at their homes.
Mitra Kakar, a student of 11th grade, was banned from attending her school when the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in August last year. She visits such places to study books, practice drawing, and hang out with friends.
It has been almost a year since we were left out of school. When the Taliban came to power, we were told not to attend our classes. Since then, I have been going through tough times, but I never quit receiving my education. I got an English class and started learning drawings. I also love books and libraries like this. I just hope our school reopens and I can make it to the university. I want to study fine arts.
This place is also becoming a stage for women to speak out. One of the women rights activists here told us that the Afghan women are facing a rollback on their rights since the Taliban's return to power.
If we look through history, Afghanistan has had many prominent, creative, and leading women in different arenas. But since we live under the Taliban rule, it looks like this chain is unfortunately being broken, with women women being sidelined or disappearing from active social life. We will keep raising our voices and defend our rights. Neither Islam nor Afghan culture has barred women from getting an education or going to work.
Afghan women rights activists also call on the global community to take serious and practical steps for women rights in Afghanistan. They say that merely condemnations can't relieve their pain, but the international community needs to come forward to press the Taliban to change their stance and uphold the rights of women and girls. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Rights groups have condemned the death of a 6-year-old Palestinian boy, Farouk Abu Naja, who died last week in Gaza after Israel denied him an exit permit to travel to Al-Quds for urgent medical care. 4 patients, including 3 children, have died so far this year because of the inhumane Israeli practice. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished territory can be a stressful and unpredictable process.
Israel is fully responsible for the death of the child, according to the 4th Geneva Convention. This case is yet another example of Israel's continuous violation of international humanitarian law and human rights law. Denying access to necessary medical care for a child is unwarranted and grave.
We met with the family of Farouk Abu Naja in the southern Gaza Strip, town of Khan Yunis.
When Farouk was born, he was a healthy child, but at the age of 3, he started showing signs of sickness and weakness. His health started to deteriorate, and he was diagnosed with cerebral atrophy. Doctors in Gaza referred him to a hospital in Al-Quds. We applied for an Israeli permit twice, but we were told that his care is under security review. Israel killed my son. Farouk died Wednesday night while waiting for the permit.
Over 1,000 Palestinian patients have lost their lives in the Gaza Strip since 2007. The large number of deaths highlights the lethal impact of Israel's crippling blockade on nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the coastal enclave.
The crippling Israeli blockade and the arbitrary restriction have battered the health sector in Gaza. Hospitals suffer from acute shortage of essential drugs and medical devices and insufficient number of specialized health professionals. Local hospitals are unable to treat many serious diseases, and so raising the number of patients referred for treatment abroad.
Hospitals in the Gaza Strip lack many essential drugs they need to treat patients suffering from severe illnesses. Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many patients is likely to further deteriorate.
The Israeli blockade has had a devastating impact on the health and the well-being of people in the Gaza Strip since 2007. Hundreds of Palestinian patients have already lost their lives in recent years in the besieged enclave due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Over 16 months of on-and-off discussions over the revival of the JCPOA appear to be nearing an end, with Tehran reviewing the U.S. response to its amendments on a recent EU draft proposal aimed at reviving the accord. The negotiations started after U.S. President Joe Biden took power on a pledge to correct the mistakes of his predecessor, Donald Trump. That's the man who unilaterally abandoned JCPOA in 2018 and launched a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. President Ebrahim Raisi has now reiterated Iran's conditions for an agreement. They include the settlement of safeguards issues between Iran and the UN nuclear agency.
What have been raised are first assuring guarantees, second, the verification of the sanctions removal in an objective and practical manner, third, the removal of sanctions in a meaningful and sustainable way, and fourth, an end to what I call political accusations regarding safeguard issues.
Raisi argued that it's pointless to restore the deal without putting an end to those safeguards accusations. He was referring to the IAEA recently asking Iran to provide explanations for what it called traces of enriched uranium at some of its undeclared sites. Tehran says these are baseless accusations coming from Israel. In his presser, Raisi was asked to comment on Israel's recent threats that it won't be bound by a JCPOA revival agreement and it will do everything to prevent Iran from attaining a nuclear capability. The president said the regime can never hinder Iran's nuclear progress.
The Zionist regime's threats against Iran have led to nowhere. The assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists was meant to stop Iran's progress in the nuclear field, but we were not stopped. Many acts of sabotage and seditions were aimed at stopping us, but we were not stopped. And no measure by the Zionist regime and the arrogant powers will stop Iran from its right to obtain nuclear energy.
Deal or no deal, Iran appears set to resolve its sanctions problems once and for all. Raisi says Tehran pursues efforts to nullify the sanctions concurrent with its efforts to get the sanctions removed. He cited a huge boost in Iran's exports since his government was formed last year, pointing to a five-fold increase in Iran's trade with regional countries.
The final act of terror by the U.S. before ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan was targeting a civilian car with a missile and killing 10 members of a family last year. 2-year-old Somaya was the youngest and 6 other victims were under 18. 3 adults were also among the fatalities. This deadly strike took place by the U.S. forces amid their evacuation following the Taliban's return to power.
We heard a very terrifying sound. We were running like crazy to get there. We saw a car burning in fire. People were killed. There was a lot of smoke and people were screaming. The U.S. said there was ISIS in that house, but later they confessed they were all civilians.
So, were there others killed? Yes.
U.S. officials tried so hard not to utter the word civilians at first, but later they confessed that the strike was a mere mistake, taking the lives of 10 innocent people.
And acknowledge our mistakes.
The last memory from U.S. presence in Afghanistan is the drone strike that killed 7 children. During their presence, the Americans conducted thousands of similar operations, killing countless civilians. They use this attack to turn the media away from their shameful pullout. They do such actions by breaking legal and international standards. This was a war crime, and the perpetrators should have been tried.
According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, more than 900 civilians have been killed in the U.S. airstrike since 2015 in Afghanistan, and so far, no one has been held accountable. The drone strike that took the lives of 7 children and 3 adults showed once more that the victims of the U.S. missions are mostly innocent civilians. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
In the limelight.
Small teams of U.S. Special Operations Forces are involved in a low-profile proxy war program on a far greater scale than previously known, according to exclusive documents and interviews with more than a dozen current and former government officials. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Nick Turris and Alice Sperry, authors. This article is published under the heading, How the Pentagon Uses a Secretive Program to Wage Proxy Wars. Stay tuned for more. The small teams of U.S. Special Operations Forces are involved in a low-profile proxy war program on a far greater scale than previously known, according to exclusive documents and interviews with more than a dozen current and former government officials. While The Intercept and other outlets have previously reported on the Pentagon's use of the secretive, 127E, Authority in Multiple African Countries, a new document obtained through the Freedom of Information Act offers the first official confirmation that at least 14 127E programs were also active in the West Asia and Asia-Pacific regions as recently as 2020. In total, between 2017 and 2020, U.S. commandos conducted at least 23 separate 127E programs across the world. Separately, Joseph Votel, a retired four-star Army general who headed both the Special Operations Command and Central Command, which oversees U.S. military efforts in the West Asia region, confirmed the existence of previously unrevealed 127E counterterrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. Another former senior defense official who requested anonymity to discuss a classified program confirmed that an earlier version of the 127E program had also been in place in Iraq. A 127E program in Tunisia, codenamed Obsidian Tower, which has never been acknowledged by the Pentagon or previously identified as a use of 127E authority, resulted in combat by U.S. forces alongside local surrogates in 2017, according to another set of documents obtained by The Intercept. A third document, a secret memo that was redacted and declassified for release to The Intercept, sheds light on hallmarks of the program, including use of authority to provide access to areas of the world otherwise inaccessible even to the most elite U.S. troops. The documents and interviews provide the most detailed picture yet of an obscure funding authority that allows American commandos to conduct counterterrorism operations by with and through foreign and irregular partner forces around the world. Basic information about these missions, where they are conducted, their frequency and targets, and the foreign forces the U.S. relies on to carry them out, are unknown even to most members of relevant congressional committees and key State Department personnel. Through 127E, the U.S. arms, trains, and provides intelligence to foreign forces. But unlike traditional foreign assistance programs, which are primarily intended to build local capacity, 127E partners are then dispatched on U.S.-directed missions, targeting U.S. enemies to achieve U.S. aims. The foreign participants in a 127 ECHO program are filling gaps that we don't have enough Americans to fill. A former senior defense official involved with the program told The Intercept, adding, if someone were to call a 127 ECHO program a proxy operation, it would be hard to argue with them. Retired generals with intimate knowledge of the 127E program, known in military parlance as 127 ECHO, say that it is extremely effective in targeting militant groups while reducing risk to U.S. forces. But experts told The Intercept that use of the little-known authority raises grave accountability and oversight concerns and potentially violates the U.S. Constitution. One of the documents obtained by The Intercept puts the cost of 127E operations between 2017 and 2020 at $310 million, a fraction of U.S. military spending over that time period, but a significant increase from $25 million budget allocated to the program when it was first authorized under a different name in 2005. Thank you. Critics contend that due to a lack of oversight, 127 e-programs risk involving the United States in human rights abuses and entangling the U.S. in foreign conflicts, unbeknownst to Congress and the American people. Former commanders say the 127E authority is crucial to combating terrorism. For more than a year, the White House has failed to provide The Intercept with substantive comment about operations by U.S. commandos outside conventional war zones, and specifically failed to address the use of 127E programs. Critics of 127E warn that in addition to the risk of unanticipated military escalation and the potential cost of engaging in up to a dozen conflicts around the world, some operations may amount to an unlawful use of force. Because most members of Congress, including those directly responsible for overseeing foreign affairs, have no input and little visibility into where and how the programs are run, 127E related